Hey, Andrea, did you ever hear the one about the podcast?
No, tell me.
Well, there was this podcast, and one of the co-hosts was actually an escaped mental patient. And on the eighth day of her treatment in a mental institution, she escaped. Then she started this podcast, and on the eighth episode, she killed her co-host at the end of the episode.
Oh my God, that's so scary. Where did you hear this?
It happened to a friend of mine, who's dead.
Then it has to be true.
Yeah, she like told me before she went to record the last podcast, and she was all joking about it, and then she totally died. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror. This is our eighth episode, and I'm Alex West, one of your co-hosts with
Andrea Subisati, as ever.
And we are still podcasting from the Horrid Halls. School is back in session, and so are we. So in today's episode, we're trying something a little bit different, but hopefully you'll dig on it. We are going to be talking about urban legends in film.
Last week, we discussed folklore as a gauge for the values of the society that created them. Today, we get more specific.
So now to start with, I think we all think we know what urban legends are, but I think some definition of terms is in order. An urban legend can be defined as an often lurid story or anecdote that's based on hearsay and widely circulated as true. More often than not, there's something that happens to a friend of a friend, which makes it seem like it's really close to you, and yet it's not really verifiable. And in my experience, I almost feel like when I hear something that sounds like an urban legend, I don't want it to be verifiable because its merit and its purpose, which we're going to get into in this episode, it kind of doesn't matter. It's a story. And you differentiate an urban legend from something like a myth, for example, which is a usually traditional story of historical events, and they serve to unfold part of the worldview of a people or to explain a certain practice or belief or something supernatural. Now, a legend, by comparison, is a story coming down from the past that's popularly regarded as historical, even though, again, it's not verifiable. The difference is in the historical context. As an urban legend is something that kind of happens in modernity. So I read somewhere that sociologists and anthropologists almost prefer to call it a contemporary legend as opposed to an urban one because it doesn't actually have to do with urban or rural or suburban or anything like that.
So just to put it in a different context, a legend would be something like the legend of King Arthur and the Arthurian court. Also something like Paul Bunyan for something a bit more contemporary. And a myth would be something like the myth of Icarus, the fella who flew too close to the sun. That's a fantastic metaphor. It gets used a lot and kind of referenced a lot, but it's much more fantastical and less based in our kind of understanding of everyday life.
Right. And most importantly for our purposes is myths often have a morality message inherent in it. So Paul Bunyan, you know, created the U.S. supposedly. He created the Grand Canyon by dragging his axe or something like that. Whereas the myth of Icarus kind of teaches us not to reach beyond our boundaries and stuff. So the morality message inherent in legends and urban legends are mostly what we're going to be talking about today and what they have to do with horror film, which also tend to contain morality messages.
So in this episode, we're going to tackle two films that on some levels are quite different from each other, and then on other levels are almost scarily similar to each other. So those films are Candyman, the 1992 film, written and directed by Bernard Rose, and then the 1998 film, aptly titled Urban Legends, and that one was directed by some hack.
They are the legends we've all heard.
Gang members drive around at night with their headlights off, and when someone goes to flash in their high beams to warn them,
the stories we've all told.
A guy and a girl, and they're parked out in the woods.
The guy steps out, and the girl starts to hear these scratching noises. It's her dead boyfriend hung from a tree.
The tales we've all listened to.
Isn't there another story about a guy with an axe hiding in a woman's backseat?
My mom still checks the backseat before getting into a car.
But just because it never happened doesn't mean it never will.
The decapitated body was found in her car.
I knew I should have gone to NYU.
This girl, she could have been any one of us.
What if there is a lunatic on campus?
What is he gonna do next, huh? Maybe put spider eggs in bubble gum?
The idea of an urban legend serial killer, it's a stretch.
The call's coming from inside the house.
Could it be an urban legend?
Something I can help you with.
I want to know what's going on here.
Someone out there is taking all these urban legends and making them reality.
Urban legend.
Have you heard the one about the microwave?
The writer Stephen King has a book called Danse Macabre, and it's a really great book. It's a series of, I would say, informal essays about horror and things that scare us. And he tackles everything from contemporary movies to classic movies to horror fiction to TV. It's really just kind of this fun conversation that he has between himself and his reader about what horror is and what place it has. Now, he has a whole section in this book called Tales of the Hook. And by that, he means the urban legend where the young lovers amorously make out in a car of Lover's Lane. And the young woman hears scratching at the door, and there's some kind of report over the radio that a killer with a hook has escaped from mental institution and is going to be attacking people in the area. The boyfriend eventually relents, trying to have sex with her, drives her home, and when he goes to open her door to let her out, he sees the hook has been lodged in the door. So it's that kind of sense of a primordial dread that something we hear, some kind of inclination through suggestion, is actually real. So it's that sense of that kind of unexplainable noise that you hear right before you go to sleep is actually like the woman in black going to jump out at you and get you. But he says, Stephen King says, that in this context, horror in general offers no characterization, no theme, no particular artifice. It does not aspire to symbolic beauty. So I kind of take that to mean that it's just this kind of general sense of dread. It's something very primal that we all experience and we all understand. It's not a kind of grand gothic tradition. It's not even a grindhouse tradition, to go on to the other side of the scale. It is something pure and simple. And then when different artists create horror, they draw from that sense of dread and that sense of fear, and they build upon it to create their own stories and their own versions of this legend.
That's right. And say what you want about jump scares. I'm not too fond of them, but a function that they do serve is that there's a couple of instances where I thought I heard something and it was nothing, but you can't totally distrust your senses because apparently you think you heard something and you did. Now, different permutations of that hook story that I've heard in my lifetime are that, you know, the guy actually gets killed and disappears, and the girl drives home and finds the hook. So different permutations of the story serve to illustrate that there's not a whole lot of artistry involved. You can make it as dramatic as you want, but more or less it's the same thing.
And that sense of sharing and the story evolving through each telling, you know, that creates a real sense of community, the sense of being able to share a story with someone else, to pass on a story, and the sense of this is secret and I'm going to tell you something to warn you or to scare you. It creates kind of a camaraderie, whether intentional or not, between people. And now with the advent of the internet that we're all kind of dealing with and growing with as it progresses, these things are spreading a lot faster. So you could even classify a movie like The Ring or Ringu as an urban legend, which is how they kind of posit it at the beginning of the film. It's a small story that kind of spreads. And The Ring is a great example because it becomes viral and it spreads even further.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it?
The internet is also fertile ground to its own kinds of urban legends. Like, for example, I don't know if you've all been swept up with a notice that Facebook is going to start selling your information to Nazi scientists and you are in great danger unless you share this. And everybody's sharing it, and then eventually everybody gets mad and it's like, this is a hoax, this is a scam, what are you doing? This is annoying on my feed.
And that's how the Nazi scientists win.
Or maybe you heard a rumor that, I think I heard one that Mariah Carey was dead. I didn't particularly give a shit.
Well, actually, I remember on the night that Andrea and I met, we were hanging out, and I think, Andrea, you were checking your phone at some point. I think it was Twitter or something, and you found out Whitney Houston had died. And immediately, like, this buzz kind of happened around us because you were like, oh my God, Whitney Houston! And then we all went to our phones to verify it, not just through social media, which is kind of its own urban legend in its own mind, but we had to go to news sources and start verifying it through there. But even they get it wrong sometimes.
First of all, let's get one thing straight. Crack is cheap. I make too much money to ever smoke crack. Let's get that straight, okay? We don't do crack. Don't do that. Crack is whack.
And so I think another thing is that these urban legends tend to be really pervasive, especially in our childhoods. I certainly remember hearing them all through a TV show. I know it aired in Canada. I don't know if it aired anywhere else, called Freaky Stories. That was a great, fun TV show, and they used to animate kind of less bloody versions of all these different urban legends, and it was a really fun watch. Now, another thing beyond the playground was a lot of my friends liked to tell the plots of horror movies they'd seen as an urban legend. So it was this very secretive thing where they kind of drag you to one side of the yard and be like, oh my God, I saw the craziest movie. It's this movie called Sleepaway Camp, and it's totally based on a real story. And this girl then proceeded to describe the plot of Sleepaway Camp all up until the end, convinced that it was real. So it's kind of evolved into this place where we understand anything scary to not be real and that it probably existed in some other form at some other time. Countless cases of this through film history. One of my favorites, which was something I found in my research during my master's, was obviously Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The original one opens with that great scroll of John Larroquette reading the events that are about to happen and insisting that they are real.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths, in particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Now, what's interesting about that is there's no truth to that at all. There is a small kernel of truth in the serial killer of Ed Gein. Now, he was a serial killer in the 60s. Alfred Hitchcock based Psycho off of him. They kind of took elements of him for Leatherface. And more recently, that's what Thomas Harris kind of based elements of Buffalo Bill and Hannibal Lecter on for Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter and all of those stories. And what's even more interesting about that is that story has evolved into such an interesting place where at a convention, it was Gunnar Hansen who played Leatherface, has had fans come up to him and say, oh man, you were so good as Leatherface, and I know because my uncle did time with Leatherface. And Gunnar Hansen said, I calmly explained to these people that this is not true and Leatherface never existed. And, you know, if he had, we would all know about it. But they are so convinced that Leatherface was in a jail just outside their town, and then they're, you know, so-and-so did time with him, so they know all this messed up stuff about him, and that it's so real that even the actor who originated the role cannot convince them otherwise.
So horror movies and urban legends are inexorably linked. I feel like they serve a lot of the same functions in society. And by function, I don't necessarily mean the Durkheimian, this is how society works because these things exist, but it perpetuates and it's persistent. So it is serving a function of some sort. But insofar as some urban legends are derived out of movies, we have several examples of movies that are derived out of urban legends, which is what we're going to be talking about today. So the first film we're going to talk about, we already alluded to The Man with the Hook. So we're going to talk about A Certain Hooked Man. This movie scared the bejesus out of me. I saw it when I was quite young and alone and at night, and it was a very, very effective film, 1992's Candyman.
Have you ever heard of Candyman? And if you look in the mirror, you say his name 5 times.
In cities everywhere.
Candyman?
They whisper his name.
Right. Candyman.
It's just a story.
Candyman.
Candyman.
Just a ghost story.
Candyman.
An entire community starts attributing the daily horrors of their lives to a mythical figure.
The legend first appeared in 1890. He was attacked, mutilated, and burned to death. Poor Candyman.
Helen, a woman died in there. Leave it.
Everyone knows he isn't real.
That's modern oral folklore.
Everyone. Except Helen Lyle.
Bernadette.
It ain't safe around here.
That don't scare too easy. Y'all know about Ruthie Jean? They ain't never gonna catch him. Who? Candyman.
Helen.
Who is that?
I came for you.
Do I know you?
Now, she is about to discover...
Helen?
Get out! Get out!
What's behind the mystery?
I'm sick.
What's behind the legend?
Listen, he's under the bed!
And most terrifying of all...
Come with me.
What's behind the mirror?
He's here.
Candyman, you don't have to believe. Just beware.
So for those of you that don't know the plot of Candyman, Helen Lyle, played by Virginia Madsen, is a grad student, not unlike Andrea and myself, but her thesis is on urban legend, and she's studying in Chicago. Her husband is a professor at the university, and he's kind of a skeezball. So as she and her friend Bernadette are going into research more and more of these urban legends, Helen stumbles across the legend of Candyman, where it seems to have its roots in Chicago, in particular the projects of Cabrini Green. So Helen and Bernadette go to investigate this urban legend, which apparently is real, and a lot of the residents who are, you know, poor and impoverished and decidedly lower class all believe in. Now, once they get in and Helen has an encounter with the supposed real Candyman, who's more of a gang figure in this case, she manages to put him in jail, and then the real Candyman, played by the one and only Tony Todd, comes to visit her. He then starts setting her up as a murderer time and again until she's finally forced to face him. And in facing him, she's able to save the baby who she was first believed to have killed. She dies, unfortunately, but the baby is saved. Now, throughout this whole film, Candyman is kind of saying to her, be my victim. The story has to live on beyond me.
Be my victim. I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom. Without these things, I am nothing. So now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
Now, at the end of this film, Helen learns that her husband has been cheating on her the whole time with one of his students. So after her tragic death, where she saves this baby, she comes back and brutally kills her husband, which terrifies the young student he's banging, who apparently doesn't know what a bra is.
Trevor? Trevor?
Now, one of the really interesting things to me about Candyman is the use of class throughout this film. Now, it's the kind of ivory tower academics like Helen, her friend Bernadette, her husband, and their kind of associates who all have a dinner party scene together, who talk about Candyman as this thing that they understand, that they've done research on, and they've been able to kind of put in a box and put it away. But the residents of Cabrini Green still believe in this mythical figure. They believe it's something to be scared of and that they actively fear. So through this, the academics are able to just kind of, you know, pat them on the head and say, poor you, which kind of Helen does. Even though she's quite empathetic to them, it's still very much a like, oh, that's a bit sad that they believe that. And then once Helen is kind of put in the nightmare where she knows Candyman is real and he set his sights on her, her status rapidly lowers throughout the film as she is put in mental institutions, she's being charged with murder, and people around her start to desert her.
So Helen is out of her element in several different ways, not just the class-based element or the racial element or socioeconomic element, but she's an academic and she's dealing in some very supernatural type things that she's not really used to having to deal with because she's an academic and science explains everything, right?
And there's a great article by, I think, one of our favorite writers, John Kenneth Muir, and I will link this on Facebook and Twitter, where he talks about urban legends in film and TV. And I highly recommend, if you're interested in this topic, you take a look at this piece because it's very well written and very informative. And he makes a really great point when he talks about Candyman, because he really deals with the fact that the community of Cabrini Green cannot face the literal figure of Candyman, who at the beginning of the film is just kind of like a gang member. They have to kind of put Candyman, quote unquote, as this mythical figure. They actively cannot look themselves in the mirror. They cannot face what problems are around them. They can, you know, put them somewhere else, but they can't deal with the fact that their neighbor is the one making them all scared and terrified. So, I mean, that really goes into the literal versus figurative presence in the film and the aggression versus blame in the film. So they can blame this mythical figure and put their aggression towards him, but they can't actually deal with the real figure because they're all so scared of him, because they are scared of getting hurt or killed or threatened.
In retribution for what they did to him. And there's a shade of this kind of in movies like Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, where it's past crimes coming back to haunt you, and how turning a blind eye is actually the worst thing of all. Now, Candyman, for his part, his objective, while punishing people for sure, but he also doesn't want you to forget. So past crimes have to be remembered and lessons have to be learned. So it's a cautionary tale that he wants to reteach the new populations.
And one of the things I really love most about this movie, and especially again watching it this time, was that the power transfer in that film, where Helen kind of defeats Candyman, she won't let him have that kind of, she won't stay with him, you know, she doesn't want to take that power. She wants to save this child. She wants to give this baby back to its mother. That's the most important thing to her, which I think is an incredible story arc for that character. And the fact that she kind of transfers herself into an urban legend. So the fact that at the end of the film, as she's being put into a grave after she's died, not alive, after she's died, and then the residents of Cabrini Green all come to her funeral and they drop the hook in the grave. And it's a sense of just transferring power, and they've given her the respect to give her the power to go on and perhaps avenge all of the wrongdoing that has befallen her before she died. And, you know, lest you think that's a bit weird, the final image of the film is this kind of euphoric mural of her as this kind of almost like religious figure, where she's like almost a deity now. And she's something that would almost watch over this community and is a protector. So it's kind of a more positive outcome. So this urban legend that has evolved, that Helen has become, is more about proper vengeance rather than a general terror that has befallen this community.
That's right. And Candyman also has a really iconic poster that points to all these themes. It's an eye with kind of a wasp just right in it. So it just kind of, you know, it's a depiction of the gaze, but with a sting. Another interesting thing about the Candyman urban legend is that it's kind of a masculization of the Bloody Mary legend. Now, Bloody Mary is obviously a historical figure who has earned her nickname by bathing in the blood of her virgin handmaidens to preserve her youth and beauty. That's an urban legend, and it's said that if you look in the mirror and say Bloody Mary three times, Bloody Mary will appear and she will kill you by bleeding you out. So that's kind of a very feminine version of the urban legend, both in the bloodletting and the fact that Mary is in fact a lady.
Have you ever done Bloody Mary?
I think so. I think someone dared me to when I was a kid and I was just crazy enough to do it.
See, I never did. I think I tried once and I got to two, and then I lied and said I did three.
You chickened out?
I totally chickened out.
That's brutal. Let's go do it right now.
Really? Will the cord stretch this far?
Okay, so I've got a mirror right here. Are you ready?
Okay.
Are we supposed to look at ourselves or each other? Or
we're supposed to look at ourselves.
At ourselves. Okay, so you ready? Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary. Bloody. Oh, you chickened out again! You're the worst!
I don't want to do it.
So Candyman was our first example of a movie tackling an urban legend per se and naming it as such. But along comes 1998, and we've got this horrible 90s teen slasher film called Urban Legend.
Horrible to some, entertaining to others. Now, Urban Legend...
You're not going to tell me you liked it.
I did like it. I don't, like, love it. It's just a really fun, goofy movie. And it's shot in Toronto. It's shot on my old campus. That's fun.
Urban Legends, to me, just represents the prototypical, shitty 90s horror movie that came out when I was in high school. And all my high school friends were like, let's go see this. And I'd be like, let's not. Let's... Never mind what I wanted to do. And they'd be like, but you like horror? And I would be so offended that this would even be lumped in with what it was that I liked. So it was painful to me, and it was painful on the rewatch. But anyway, take it away, Alex. Why was it awesome?
Oh, no. As you'll remember, Andrea, we don't critique in this podcast. We discuss. But I will say, it's, to me, a fun movie. It's not quite as offensive, though I do see Andrea's point. But to keep in mind, this was, you know, in 2 years, less than 2 years after Scream came out. So I kind of rate these films as like, well, Scream came out first, and then about a year later, I Know What You Did Last Summer came out. And then shortly after I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend came out. So it was really trying to cash in on that whole Scream formula that had been created. I don't think you can talk about the theme of Urban Legends without dealing with the film Urban Legends, whether you like it or not. This film lives and dies by the use of urban legends. So basically, a group of young, attractive college students start getting picked off one by one via varying urban legends. Some of them more accurate than others. Some of them just get killed. Like Tara Reid just dies.
To our delight.
So she just dies. But a lot of other people had these kind of big epic death scenes that are kind of fetishized and over the top. And it's great because, like, Robert Englund shows up for a bit and overacts. And, you know, then you have John Neville, who's this brilliant Shakespearean actor who kind of wanders in for a few scenes and gets his ankles slashed. But at the end of it, what we come to learn throughout the whole film is that Natalie, who is our final girl in this film, actually took part in an urban legend that went awry a few years before. She and her friend had tried to do this flashing of the lights while driving gang initiation urban legend. And by doing so and following a guy who flashed his lights at them to, you know, say, your lights aren't on, actually drove him off the road by accident, killing him. So she reveals this towards the end of the film to Jared Leto, because you tell everything to Jared Leto.
He's so dreamy.
And then what's revealed is that the killer, the perpetrator of all these urban legend deaths, is actually the guy who died's girlfriend. She has been using urban legends to punish the initial urban legend. And the film ends with them subduing her. She's apparently dead, but then she escapes at the end. And it kind of fades to black, and then it fades up again, and it seems to be like a year later, and it reveals that she's in another university telling another urban legend of what happened to those college kids.
Look, does anybody here believe me?
Not a chance, no.
I believe you.
Thank you.
But you didn't tell it right.
I didn't.
Not at all. Okay, listen up, guys. Because this is how the story really goes.
And she spends the bulk of the movie being the supposed best friend of our final girl. So, cautionary tale, don't trust your friends. Girls are bitches. They're going to make out with the guys you're crushing on and try to kill you.
So I think one of the most important things to kind of pinpoint about Urban Legends, the film, is that it's similar qualities with Candyman. So Urban Legends does take place on a college campus. So while the characters are studying Urban Legends, and that seminar, that class is taught by Robert Englund.
You see, the babysitter and the man upstairs is what we call an urban legend. Contemporary folklore passed on as a true story. Now, there are variations of this one going back to the 1960s, all of them containing the same cultural admonition.
So once these murders start happening, and Natalie's quite quick to realize that these are all urban legends, and they're all falling in the pattern of urban legends, all of her friends are very dismissive of this notion. No, that's not true. That guy's not dead. He's at a bachelor party. You know, she tells the campus police. She tells the dean. No one believes her because they're all better than that, because urban legends are through and through fake. They don't really have a kernel of truth. They don't really exist, so we have nothing to fear. So the idea that a killer was perpetrating all these murders based on them was incredibly ridiculous. No one believed that. And it's not until the very end of the film where all of the characters have been picked off, or the killer, Brenda, has mortally wounded a lot of them, that they all kind of come around and believe, oh yeah, you were totally right about that. And the film also does a really great thing where it vilifies the bystander. It vilifies the person who maybe didn't commit the act, but participated in the act, and in some ways passed it on. So that is the real villain of the piece. Not necessarily Brenda, because you can almost understand why she did all of that. It's, you know, the Natalie character who stood by her friend while she was, you know, running down this guy for no good reason, and she didn't stop her.
Now you took him away from me!
Brenda, I wasn't...
You were driving! But it was your car, and you were there, Natalie!
And the film also does another really interesting thing with status. So just as we were talking about in Candyman, the graduate student of Helen Lyle versus the, you know, residents of Cabrini Green, there is a sense that Brenda, who's played by Rebecca Gayhart in this film, is this very kind of silly, petty kind of girl. Like, she just likes a guy, and she just wants to go to parties, and she just wants to hang out. And so she's very gullible and not very bright.
Had those before?
Yeah, they're Pop Rocks. They crackle in your mouth.
Eat some. Thirsty? What's wrong? Something you might have heard about mixing pop rocks and soda?
Well, supposedly, your stomach and your intestines, everything burst.
Really? Anyone you know die this way?
Mikey, from the cereal commercial. Give it to Mikey, he'll eat anything.
She's also an attractive female, and far be it from me to bring gender into this discussion, but you don't really expect this killer, who we only see in a big coat and boots and wielding an axe and pretty considerable physical strength. We definitely don't suspect Brenda.
And actually, I think that's probably one of the most notable thing about urban legends is that the killer is a female. So that's where I've seen it cited most. You know, it's kind of up there in those, you know, lists you see on blogs and articles and on web pages. You know, those articles about women killers in films. So you'll have, yes, like Friday the 13th and urban legends are kind of two of the big ones that I've seen referenced a lot. So that's where it gets most of its notoriety. But it's, you know, the person you least suspect, which is kind of a cliche in a lot of other types of genre films or in a lot of other genres. But in this case, it's, you know, you expect her to get picked off so early, but she never does. And I also think this film mirrors, so to speak, Candyman, in that this is not about just fear, plain and simple. This is about a past trauma. Now, rather than a remembrance of a past trauma, this is a past trauma that needs to be rectified. Brenda needs to fix this. Brenda wanted to hurt Natalie in all the ways she had been hurt with her boyfriend or fiance's death. So there is a really interesting element of punishment in this film. A lot of the characters and a lot of the deaths have to do with a punishment that each character deserves. Now, while in Candyman, there is an element of blame, but it's more in memorialization, so it's a sense of remembrance. This is a sense that there was a misdeed, and that misdeed must be righted. Had the misdeed never happened, none of these events would have happened. So I think they share a kernel of truth. I think they share that kernel of a trauma, but the way they're dealt with is quite different. So the memorialization kind of leads to this lifetime of fear for this community that almost had nothing to do with that. And we're actually kind of, you know, alongside Candyman, the victims of these kind of crimes. But it is in urban legends where you have, you know, the kind of middle class, upper middle class, rich, pretty white people who just get to punish each other in really, you know, graphic and horrific ways because they feel it is their right to do it. They feel it is their right to take vengeance when they have been hurt.
That's right. It's kind of an interesting microcosm of the universe. I mean, there's tons of horror movies about college students, but college campuses are very gossipy places, and they're kind of really fertile ground for stuff like urban legends and stuff to proliferate. And you're going to class and you have access to all of these ideas, but more often than not, you don't get to put them into practice. So I think that was kind of a little irony in the movie. So there are numerous examples of urban legends showing up in horror movies. Most notably cited is When a Stranger Calls from 1979.
This audience is watching what the film critic for After Dark magazine has called the most terrifying movie I have ever seen.
Trace the call. It's coming from inside the house. Just get out of that house.
Every babysitter's nightmare becomes real when a stranger calls.
And if you're not familiar, this is a really classic. If you haven't heard it as a movie, you've probably heard it as an urban legend where someone is babysitting a couple of kids and she's getting these menacing phone calls and discovers that the calls are coming from inside the house. Pretty obvious cautionary tale to women, as a warning to women that, you know, this is a story of someone who failed in her role as parent or caretaker to these children, and also as a teen's failure to perform their first ever job. So it kind of reflects these social anxieties.
Yeah, and it has a lot to do with keeping and maintaining your social responsibility, about understanding your role and only taking it when you're fully ready, and not only what will happen to you if you fail, but what will happen to those around you if you fail. Because, of course, I think there is a less graphic version that I've heard of the urban legend where the kids are fine. But then, of course, I always think of the real and the very graphic version of that urban legend is where the kids' like faces are like torn off.
Right, and we also see a bit of a shade of this in Black Christmas, which we've covered already. The calls are coming from inside the house because, what, you're a group of vulnerable women living together? What do you think is going to happen? Another example is 1980s Alligator, when there were rumors proliferating New York City that there were alligators living in the sewers. And that one's kind of interesting because the cautionary tale there is kind of like this is Mother Nature's revenge for urbanization, that if you're going to create a concrete jungle, some of the jungle is going to seep through. And that's something we also see in movies like The Shining.
The site is supposed to be located on an Indian burial ground, and I believe they actually had to repel a few Indian attacks as they were building it.
Pet Sematary.
This was their burial ground. Whose burial ground? Mi'kmaq Indians.
Just these man against nature cautionary tales.
And for those of you that aren't sick of me kind of talking or rambling on about found footage horror films, there's a whole lineage of this. I mean, one of the first found footage horror films that is kind of rated by a lot of people is Cannibal Holocaust. And even though some of that is shot as kind of a, you know, omniscient perspective by the camera, some of it is, you know, quote unquote found footage. So that's, I'd say, about a third of the film. Now, the director of the film, Ruggero Deodato, he actually had the actors sign a contract so that they would not appear in public or any big public event or in TV or film or a television commercial, anything like that for a year after the film had been released, because he so wanted people to believe it was real. And when it was released initially in Italy, it was almost immediately banned. And people actually really did believe his legend that Deodato had created, so much so that Deodato had to produce the actors in an Italian courtroom back in like 80 or 81. He had to fly these actors who he'd gotten from New York back over to Italy to show themselves in court and say, hello, I'm alive, I'm not dead, I did sign this contract, we're all good.
The courts accused me of really killing and torturing people. The court wanted to see the film with me, so they took me to a special room. Immediately from the judge's reaction, because he grimaced every time he saw a shocking scene, I could see that I would be convicted.
And then, of course, the other big found footage film to talk about in this regard is The Blair Witch Project. People believe this story to this day, and it's just kind of innocuous enough that it feels like it really did happen. The story is simple enough that it feels like something you would have heard about in a news report, read in a newspaper one day, thought, oh, that's kind of sad, and then forgotten about and gone on with your life. I mean, think about it. We read these things all the time. And then so to actually see kind of the behind the scenes and the like what really happened, quote unquote, is actually quite powerful. Now, just out of a little anecdote of my own, when I was working on my final papers of my master's, one of them was about horror films that purport to be real. So I had to do this whole little presentation. I was up in front of the class, you know, going through my little PowerPoint and talking about all these things. And I bring up the slide of the Blair Witch Project. And I say, and of course, now we all know this is fake. And this was 2 years ago, two, 3 years ago now. And one girl in that class went, what? She still thought the Blair Witch Project was a real documentary. I talked to her afterwards, and she was bright and a lovely girl. She really thought that movie was still real until I showed her, like, the Times cover and, you know, things like that with Heather and Josh and Mike.
And so I saw an ad that said that it was going to be a completely improvised feature film shot in a wooded location. Shooting was going to suck as much as you can possibly imagine anything sucking,
right,
and show up at Musical Theater Works.
But it is a great thing because they really, Dan Murek and Eduardo Sanchez, really understood what the core of an urban legend is. It is something that kind of is situated in something real. So there was the persecution of women who were believed to be witches in that era, the history of America, and what actually would happen if one of them was a witch and had the power to live on, and what would happen if three people went looking for her. And of course, this has gone on far beyond this, where you have films like The Fourth Kind, which is that very odd Mila Jovovich movie about the aliens in Alaska. And that, I believe, was done by Universal. And the amount of work they put into their campaign to be like, this is real, this is totally real, 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 that the town in Alaska where they set it actually sued them to stop them from using this name, because all the people that had supposedly gone missing from alien abductions had actually very sadly passed away due to alcohol poisoning and frozen in Alaska. So they, you know, they had to reclaim their trauma, so to speak, and tell them to stop, because it was actually very hurtful to this town and these people's families.
And this is really the big difference between urban legends as they exist in rumors and in folklore and urban legends as they exist in horror movies. As horror movies, we know that they're not real. Even the found footage ones that most of us know and can prove, it's verifiable. We can look it up online or look up the Time cover like you did for that chick and prove that these things aren't real. Whereas urban legends, they're not verifiable. We kind of don't believe them, but we kind of don't really want that truth because it kind of lives in this different world, whereas movies are entertainment, they're sheer artifice. So I feel like that's an important distinction. And while horror fans watch horror movies, everybody talks urban legends and everybody has these stories and talks about them. So they also have a really wider reach. So I almost feel like urban legends are like a sister or maybe a cousin, maybe like an in-law to horror movies. But this is why I wanted to talk about them, is they're related directly and indirectly, but they serve similar functions in society, and it was worth talking about.
And I think just about the films we've just touched on, some were in depth and some of them were just briefly, I think you can see the way that an urban legend can kind of generate itself organically versus one that is kind of forced onto an audience. I mean, The Blair Witch had timing on its side, but something like The Fourth Kind, people saw through that really quickly. You know, so there is that sense of audience savvy. And I think there's also a huge part of urban legends that has to do with nostalgia, our own kind of sense of this. These were things that got told in like the schoolyard, you know, and that we took home, and we really, like, I certainly wondered if they were real. And, you know, I saw versions of them on TV shows, and it lived in this part of my life. And I don't know if I'll ever have that same experience of it again, where I'll ever be able to kind of really wonder about something, because now I can just go onto my phone and check BBC News or CBC or, you know, CNN or something to make sure it's real or not.
So we want to hear from you. We want to hear your favorite horror movies that are based on urban legends, or your favorite urban legends that may or may not be based in horror film. One of the titles that came up in my research is The Mothman Prophecies. And I don't know if I've talked about this before, but Alex certainly knows my stance.
Well, I would also like to say that this film stars Richard Gere, who is the subject of one of my other favorite urban legends, and it involves a small rodent.
Is that true?
No, it's an urban legend.
In case you don't know what Alex is talking about, all I'm going to say is go to Wikipedia and look up the word gerbiling. That's gerbil the rodent, but a verb, gerbiling. Richard Gere's photo should come up.
Lemmy Winks journeyed a distance far and fast to find his way out of a gay man's ass. The road ahead is filled with danger and fright, but push onward, Lemmy Winks, with all of your might.
Anyway, this movie was the first time we'd seen Richard Gere in a while. I was into it. It was a scary supernatural thriller starring himself and Deborah Messing. And this movie has been celebrated in recent years as being a wonderful cult classic, but I can't stand it. It's one of those movies that I keep turning it off, and every couple of years I'm like, man, I keep hearing it's good, and I put it on again, and I keep turning it off. It does nothing for me. And insofar as it tackles an urban legend, it's very, very supernatural and very, very boring.
Duh.
And Alex would agree with me on that one.
I was trying to swim, but I was too cold. And I kept looking. I kept looking for something to hang on to. And there were presents. Floating all around me. They were wrapped up. They were tied with bows. And I tried to grab onto them, but they kept popping away.
And like we were saying, we want to hear from you. We do promise to do that feedback episode probably in the next couple of months. So if you have a favorite urban legend, if you love what we talked about, if you hated what we talked about, drop us a line. You can get us on Facebook, The Faculty of Horror, on there. You can get us on Twitter at Faculty of Horror, or you can email us at thefacultyofhorror@gmail.com. If you've hit up any of those, you'll probably notice we have a swanky new logo. Big thank you to Matthew Therrien, who did that, and it's amazing, and we love it, and I'm working on getting a tattoo of it on my face. And if you want to see more of his work, if you've got eyes, you do. So you can see his stuff at mctherrien.com, and we've linked him, and I will link him again, because he's awesome.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Yeah, a couple little things from us to plug. I was just a guest on the Rewatchability podcast. We talked about the Blair Witch Project, so if you liked what I had to say in this episode, you want to hear a bit more, you'll want to hear me drunker and talk about it, go check out that episode. It was a lot of fun, and thank you again to those guys for having me on again.
You'll also want to keep your eye on the Rue Morgue podcast in the fall, because as we might have mentioned on our podcast, I'm sure we have, Alex and I were guests on a panel at the Festival of Fear called Misadventures in Horror Podcasting, where we were joined by the notorious Stuart Feedback Andrews, the nefarious Last Chance Lance, and we were really excited to meet Mike White from the Projection Booth podcast, which we're both a big fan of, and we got to meet him, and it was great. So we're sure that that podcast recording will be up with the Rue Morgue podcast in the coming months, so keep an eye out for that. And finally, my last plug for this podcast, I swear, my pet project, The Black Museum, is in full swing for semester 3. Now, I know all of our listeners aren't all in Toronto, but those of you who are, definitely want to check out theblackmuseum.com. We've just announced our fall lineup, and it is going to be great. We are welcoming Alex back as a guest for Lecture 4. We're doing a debate called...
I think you mean the winner of Lecture 4.
We'll see. We're doing a debate on Stephen King films. We've asked a couple of teams to debate which is the best Stephen King book-to-film adaptation. And we've got 4 teams who are going to fight to the finish to defend their pick. And Alex is among them. So we're really excited for that. So stay tuned, keep listening, and...
Office hours are closed. Andrea?
Yes?
Did I ever tell you about the time I was in the mental institution? I only made it 8 days.